interesting. For the year as a whole, Chairperson, so from January to December, if we compare the annual figures with the preceding year, growth, the GDP grew by 1.3%. That's higher than was anticipated. So as recently as the budget of a few weeks ago, we still had a lower GDP figure. Agriculture, again, was the highest generator of growth, followed by mining and business services. Capital spend saw government and public enterprises spend 1% less than in 2017, and these are the pressures that we're beginning to see of the fiscal pressures. But encouragingly, the private sector spent 1.2% more after 2 years of decreases. Part of what Stats SA does is periodically it revises all of its statistics. It takes all the information that is available to it, sees where there are gaps, and every so now and then it takes the additional information that it has accumulated over the period, and it then resets all the data. So it did this resetting of the data, restating of the data, and the more interesting bit of it is the growth in 2016 went up from 0.3% to 0.6%. So that was the one more significant revision. But the other part, and it's one that I just want to draw attention to, is that the result of them resetting the figures had an impact on the estimates on GDP. So what we've provided here are the quarterly results of GDP, and I'll just use this pointer to illustrate the point for members. The blue indicates the original estimate of GDP. So honorable members will see here in this period GDP grew, and then it declined. In this would have been the fourth quarter of 2016 and again the first quarter of 2017. And then it grew again. Now in the definition of recession, it's any two quarters of consecutive decline in the GDP. It doesn't really matter if the decline is significant or nominal, but as long as you have two quarters, then you regard it as a recession. If it's quite a small decline, it's called a technical recession, meaning it meets the technical definition of recession, whilst it's not really in itself a significant drop in GDP. Now, when Stats SA revise their figures, these are included in the red. Honorable members will then see the growth was a bit higher in this quarter and that quarter. And in this quarter, instead of a decline, it was a small growth. There still was a decline in the first quarter of 2017, but no decline in the last quarter of 2016. And then, of course, a small restatement for quarter two and quarter three. The consequence of that restating is the recession that we reported last year based on Stats SA figures is now no longer regarded statistically as recession. You still have quite low growth in this period, although they encouragingly a little bit higher than originally estimated by Stats SA, but it's not a recession. I provided that because I'm sure honorable members have seen this in the media, and it may have been something that you would have liked us to just explain. Stats SA also released the provincial GDPs, but they always release it with roughly a one-year lag. So unlike all the other data, the provincial GDP figures are for 2016, not for 2017. But it was because it's just come out, and we are dealing with employment data and GDP data, we thought we'll just state the provincial GDP. What it shows in this table here indicates the size of the economy of each province by the end of 2016. So the annual size of the economy as at December 2016, Gauteng, as honorable members will see, is still by far the largest provincial economy, accounting for 34.6% of all the wealth that is generated in South Africa in 2016. It's followed by KZN and Western Cape, and thereafter by Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga and Limpopo, followed by Northwest and Free State, and finally Northern Cape. The growth rate of the different provinces are represented on the right-hand side in the table there. So Gauteng grew the strongest in that period, 1.4% GDP growth, followed by Western Cape at 1.1% and Eastern Cape 0.8% and KZN 0.7%. There were two other provinces which grew, and three provinces who in the year 2016 had a contraction in their GDP. Turning next to employment, and so we go back to 2017, we provide data for the quarter only. In other words, what happened in that three-month period compared to the previous three-month period, and then later on we go to the year as a whole. So for that 3 months compared to the previous 3 months, 21,000 jobs were lost, taking total jobs to 16.1 million, or 16.17 million, call it 16.2 million. The number of unemployed also decreased quite significantly by 330,000, resulting in an unemployment number of 5.9 million. And because the total unemployment numbers came down, the unemployment rate decreased from 27.7% to 26.7%. But we should note that the number of discouraged job seekers also increased by 103,000. And this is the very peculiar political economy of South Africa, and I've explained it previously in the committee, that we have a quite significant number of people who are not economically active, not all of whom are discouraged work seekers. And so to truly see what's happening in labor market trends, one has to look at all of them together to see when do we do well and when don't we do well. If we look at job creation as a whole, where are the jobs created? So over the 12 months, and I emphasize that it's a snapshot for the 12-month period, 102,000 jobs were created, and the bulk was in the broader public sector. So not just the public sector as it's regarded in the statistics, but also utilities, your Eskoms and Transnets and so on. And they accounted for about 153,000 jobs. In this period, we had a loss of 51,000 jobs in the private sector, hence the net impact. If you take away the job losses from the job gains, you get to the 102,000. If we look over a longer period, because this is a one-year snapshot, if we actually take our data from the time that the new growth path was adopted in 2010, when employment became a much more significant focus of government, 2.5 million additional jobs were created. So this is the net jobs after you take job losses out of the equation. And interestingly there, taking that longer period, the bulk of jobs were in fact created in the private sector, 62%, or 1.5 million jobs. And the public sector created just short of 1 million jobs. Turning next to job creation in by industry, honorable members will see here the detail that illustrates what we've just taken the committee through. And then jobs by province is the next slide, and it provides a more detailed breakdown of job losses and job gains in different provinces. The labor market trend since the NGP adoption, I've indicated the big picture to honorable members, 2.5 million extra jobs were created, but because there was a much more significant number of people who entered the labor market and became part of the labor force. Some 3.7 million additional people entered the labor market over that period. You also had unemployment going up by 1.2 million. And this slide is very interesting because it gives honorable members details on the size of the population aged 15 to 64, so 33 million in September 2010, and 37.5 million by December 2017. So the population grew by 4.4 million. That's the population in what is ordinarily known as the working age cohort. The labor force grew by 3.7 million, and the unemployed grew, the employed and the unemployed grew, as we've indicated there in the previous slide. Jobs by industry, if honorable members were interested in what's happened since the NGP has been adopted. Government narrowly, 886,000, business services, 685,000, and construction, 373,000. These were your three big job generators in this period. Obviously, government, we understand that there's been a much greater focus to expand areas that the state is providing services, and construction has been a significant part of it. It's been the infrastructure program. But you'll also see many other private sectors activities that also expanded in this period. The only sector that in fact had fewer jobs at the end of this period was manufacturing. And we'll come back to manufacturing in one of the focus sessions where we make a point about manufacturing. This really just provides information that the NGP, when it was adopted in October 2010, set a target of 5 million new jobs in 10 years. And the National Development Plan, which was adopted in 2012, took the new growth path figure. It added to that, and it extended the period to 2030. That was a significant change, and so it meant more jobs have to be created in terms of our public targets, but over a longer period. This slide just provides a bit of data on the NGP and NDP. This is the NDP target right here on top, the green line. And that we have to finally focus our attention on. That we need to achieve by 2030. This was the original, the blue one, was the original new growth path target, which as I've indicated is subsumed now in the NDP target. And the red line indicates the number of employed. And honorable members will see on the slide on the screen a sharp drop in jobs in the period from September 2008 as a result of the global economic crisis. So the global recession had a sharp, sudden impact on the South African labor market, and we lost about 1 million jobs. The new growth path was adopted in October, and from the adoption of the NGP, honorable members will see a rising job numbers, employment numbers. So you see the economy beginning to recover and the labor market beginning to recover. And we've now gone significantly above the high point that we had before the global economic crisis. Of course, the NDP's adoption, you'll also see, is associated with the jobs growth. So that is the economic and employment profile that we wanted to provide as context. And then moving now to the second part of the report, we have a few focus areas. The first is Old Mutual. They are currently headquartered in London, and they began to engage government last year about a plan to shift their headquarters and primary listing to South Africa. And we had quite extensive discussions between ourselves and Old Mutual, and agreed to a set of public interest commitments that would accompany their move to South Africa. Now, their move, I emphasize, is a recommendation of the board of Old Mutual. And they needed to get two things sorted. The first is they needed to get regulatory approvals. And secondly, once they have obtained that, they need a shareholder vote that must confirm the move. So our part has been on the regulatory approvals, and the shareholder vote must still take place sometime this year. Out of the discussions, they agreed to set up a half a billion rand fund, 500 million rand, to support small business and job creation. So this would be an additional intervention by Old Mutual, that they will increase their BEE shareholding now that they're going to be principally domiciled in South Africa. They're going to increase it to at least 25% within 3 years, which would include an employee share component. And thereafter, they will see who is the best performer in their industry of their peers, and they will at least match the best performer. So we can expect it would go higher than 25%. And then they've also agreed that not only will there not be retrenchments as a result of the return home, but they will bring about 50 high-level finance and related jobs to South Africa. Jobs that were previously performed in London will now come back to South Africa. And the implementation is now subject to shareholder approval. If the shareholders vote in favor of this, then the transaction will be implemented together with these public interest components. Next, we deal with South Africa's trade with the rest of Africa. And we make the point that we've made previously that trade benefits South Africa very significantly, and it helps to support growth in the rest of the continent. Last year, exports to the rest of the continent totaled 314 billion rand, which was about a quarter of all of our exports. Regionally, only Asia had a higher level of exports of South African products. But I should make two points. The one is we mainly sell raw materials to Asia, and we mainly sell finished products to our own continent. And unlike Asia, where it was a bit of a struggle in our relation with the rest of the continent, we run a positive trade balance. Our job numbers are there. About 250,000 South African jobs are supported by exports to the continent. And our top five exports are refined oil, trucks, electricity, chrome ore and coal. But once we break that down much more, honorable members will see many manufactured products. 7% of South African-made cars are sold in the rest of the continent, 28% of trucks, and 48% of machinery and mechanical appliances that we export are exported to the rest of Africa. So these numbers, just to contextualize them, the 7% represents 7% of all of our exports. And so with all the other numbers. African growth took a dip in 2016. For 2017, it began a little recovery. And for 2018, there's a stronger growth story coming out. This will help South Africa in a number of ways. But we make the point that as the continent grows, we will also have tougher competition from outsiders, particularly China. And we've also provided a bit of information of foreign direct investment into the continent. And honorable members will see South Africa ranks number 5 in the year 2015. China has overtaken South Africa as a foreign investor in the continent, and it's now ranked number 4, and the first top 3 spots are the investor countries that have historically had a large exposure to the continent. If we look at South African and Chinese imports, we've taken a number of countries and we've asked the question, What spot does China have and what spot does South Africa have? So in Angola, China is Angola's biggest supplier of imported products. South Africa is ranked number 5. If we take Botswana, however, we are number 1 and China is number 7. Namibia, we are number 1, China is number 3. In Kenya, China is number 2 and South Africa is number 6, and it goes right through. In Nigeria, China is the biggest provider of imported goods in the Nigerian economy. South Africa is ranked number 13. We identify some early learnings from our work. In some cases, history, language, and even colonial trade patterns still matter. And the example of Angola is interesting, that they import a lot of the manufactured goods from Portugal and Brazil. Competition is tough in African markets, and we need to constantly improve our competitiveness. That there's untapped potential, that we're beginning with these sets of studies to see the picture with our trade relations. And it's clear that if government and business work together more effectively, we can achieve more on the continent. We then turn to Zimbabwe. It's been through an extended period of volatility. And this slide shows the green is sub-Saharan growth and the red is Zimbabwean growth. And honorable members will see for a lengthy period, Zimbabwe underperformed. And it's today 3% smaller than it was in 2001. So the Zimbabwean economy has actually shrunk in that period. And the GDP per capita, this is if you average out all the wealth that's created in Zimbabwe and you distributed it per person, it's about a quarter lower than it was in 2001. We note some of the factors that contributed: high price increases and decreases, so inflation and deflation. We also look at manufacturing share of GDP. And this is an important slide, the inflation and deflation one, because if you have a strong and functioning central bank, one of its jobs is to ensure that your inflation rates do not become dysfunctional to growth. Trade with the rest of the world. Honorable members will see the data. It was circulated last week to members of the committee. But I particularly draw attention here to how important South Africa is in Zimbabwe's total imports. We account for 41.3% of all the goods that Zimbabwe imports. Singapore is higher, but that was principally due to import of oil. So it was an oil trade that spiked the numbers there. And thereafter, it's China, Zambia, and India. Trade between South Africa and Zimbabwe. In 2016, we exported 29 billion rands worth of goods, and we imported just short of 6 billion rands worth of goods. We provide, so if honorable members were interested to find out what we actually do, we provide 80% of Zimbabwe's electricity that it imports. So not all of Zimbabwe's, but of the electricity that it imports, 80% comes from South Africa. 60% of truck imports, more than 90% of iron and steel imports, all of the soap and detergent products that are imported, and 80% of primary plastics. In some products, such as soybean oil, Zimbabwe is the biggest importer of South African products, which means we just need to watch that because it means we don't have a diversified export base. So depending on what happens in Zimbabwe, it can have a significant impact on our exports of soya finished products. What does Zimbabwe import as a whole? So this is from all countries, not just from South Africa. In 2016, honorable members will see the numbers. I've also asked the team to put in 2011 just as a comparator, but that will give you that the big imports are refined fuel, maize, electricity, medicines, and soybean oil. And you'll see out of the top five, South Africa is the significant player in three of those five. What does Zimbabwe export to South Africa? It exports nickel, tobacco, chromium, cotton yarn, and tea. We then dived a bit deeper on truck sales to Zimbabwe. And in 2016, we exported just more than R1 billion worth of trucks. And that was our largest item after electricity and maize. And this provides a little bit of information, and we provide it just to give a sense of who the next competitor is after South Africa. And it's Japan, followed by the UK. Similarly, in the next slide, we look at cars. And here, Japan, from about 2013, overtook South Africa as a supplier of cars to Zimbabwe. And there's a very simple reason. Japan sells a lot of second-hand vehicles elsewhere on the African continent. So inside Japan, they basically incentivize consumers to regularly change cars and buy new cars, because Japan is a big car producer. And so then people have to sell their older cars, and that then becomes a big export market or a big export product for Zimbabwe. For Japan, and in this case, clearly to Zimbabwe. So the United States, you can see here, has virtually lost all of its car numbers, and in 2013 that was the key year when we can see the big surge in Japanese imports imports in Zimbabwe of Japanese cars. Looking forward, Zimbabwe is beginning to recover economically. The Zimbabwe Reserve Bank forecast high growth, 4.8%, and that will have a complex relationship with South African exports. The parts of the Zimbabwean economy that recovers, let's say if agriculture recovers, then it means South Africa may sell a little bit less goods. But as the Zimbabwe economy becomes stronger, Zimbabwe is also likely to import more capital goods and certain consumer goods from South Africa. And as we've made the point previously, we can expect, as Zimbabwe recovers, that other larger economies, China, Japan, and others, will begin to look to Zimbabwe as a growing market for their products. Next, we deal with inclusive growth. There has been a lot of debate about inclusive growth in the South African economy. And towards the end of last year, in November last year, we had the opportunity and the honor to host Nobel laureate Professor Joseph Stiglitz to speak at a symposium attended by senior business representatives, trade unionists, regulators, members of the judiciary, cabinet colleagues, academics, and media representatives. And here's a little picture of some of the people who attended. You'll see there the General Secretary of COSATU, you'll see the Vice Chancellor of Wits University, the Judge President of the Competition Appeal Court, together with the Minister of Trade and Industry, the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, the current Minister of Public Enterprises. At the time, he was a Member of Parliament, the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, together with the President of COSATU, a well-known competition economist and member of the Competition Tribunal, as well as the Deputy Chair of the Tribunal, a judge in the Labour Court, and a business representative, Mr. Bobby Godsell. And in the next few slides, which we have pre-circulated to the committee, we look at the key points that Professor Stiglitz made. He really looked at the African story, not just South Africa. And he said that for a number of years now, East Asia has been the model that many developing countries used. And that included a shift from import substitution to export-driven growth, manufacturing-led economies, supported by well-managed export incentives, moderate in size, and they generated foreign exchange, raised the return on education, in other words, more skills were needed in the economy and were used, provided important knowledge and technology benefits, fostered jobs in urban centers, and gave companies big production runs, so what is called economies of scale. But the East Asian model is a victim of its own success. And that is principally because productivity, particularly in manufacturing, is growing more than demand for manufactured products. What that means is you need fewer people, essentially, because you can't have significantly higher output. So your output per unit of capital and labor is improving, and the effect is that productivity boost means that manufacturing is not creating as many new jobs as we would all hope. And so he says that manufacturing is unlikely to have the developmental impact on the continent that it had in China, for example. And of course, he gave the caution, we must make sure that we don't de-industrialize it. Manufacturing doesn't shrink in our GDP, but we need a growth strategy that goes beyond only a focus on manufacturing. And the next slide provides some key points around the African continent. And it makes the point that African development strategy for the 21st century will need to look at manufacturing, but also agriculture, mining, and services. We can't have the single focus that East Asia was able to utilize. That structural transformation to achieve this won't happen without government playing a catalytic role in knowledge gaps, so training becomes key, coordinating important shifts, for example, new technologies, addressing capital market constraints, and promoting sustainable urbanization. Some of the key elements of his development strategy is set out on manufacturing, its niche marketing of niche manufacturing, more complex products. In natural resources, it's to, he floated the idea, which is now, in any event, policy that government is pursuing on a sovereign wealth fund to manage the cycles in resource-intensive economies. And the new lesson that industrial policy must look at forward, backward, and horizontal linkages. What that really says is, if you have a mining industry, not only do you want to use your platinum to make products here, but you may also want to use it to develop a capital goods sector. In other words, the drilling bits that are used in platinum mining. So you don't look only on downstream linkages, but sidestream and upstream linkages. Agriculture, modern agriculture that can be very advanced, and with a focus on learning, that agriculture is going to benefit a lot from new learnings, and services sectors. And he made the point that services thus far have had less R&D in them, so they've tended to be more employment rich compared to manufacturing. Some of that may change now with the fourth industrial revolution. And then a number of issues came out in discussion. We didn't have time to summarize what different people said, but I had hoped that we could do that. But just to give you the aggregates, the need for competition regimes to address new technological challenges, education reforms, all those issues came up. And the chairperson of the portfolio committee also, of course, attended. The next focus is on competition changes. In February last year, government announced that we would be bringing a competition bill to cabinet to look at high levels of economic concentration. And in May, in the budget vote, I provided more details of that, including the setting up of an expert panel. Slide 41 really talks about what are some of the areas that we are looking at, and this was disclosed to the committee in the budget speech. During the quarter that we're reporting on, we had quite a significant set of activities to enable the bill to get to cabinet and beyond cabinet. It included discussions in the economic cluster in government, a socio-economic impact assessment study that was prepared, engagement with lawyers, and then separately with a state law advisor, meeting with regulators, with the judge president of the Competition Appeal Court, and with the Minister of Justice. Cabinet considered the bill, and with changes approved that it be released for public consultation, we gazetted the bill, and we've already begun in this quarter engagements with business and labor at NEDLAC. So once the bill has gone through that process, it goes back to cabinet, and thereafter it would be submitted to parliament, where it would be tabled, and at that point, of course, we would then engage on the content with the portfolio committee. There are some cross-cutting initiatives that fall in more than one KPI. We will have to put them into a KPI for reporting purposes, but it includes, for example, unblocking of a land purchase for the Saldanha Industrial Development Zone. A very big piece of land is owned by the IDC, and the Saldanha IDC needed it, got stuck for various reasons, and the premier of the province requested that I help to unblock it, and in that quarter we worked on unblocking the land sale so that we can get the land productively used and jobs created. We also were provided support to the city of Cape Town on the water crisis. We seconded a senior official from the PICC to do a review of the work that was undertaken to deal with the water crisis, to identify possible remedies to try to avoid the taps running dry. And there was a good piece of cooperation between the PICC and the City of Cape Town. We engaged with the Massmart Supply Development Fund. I met with a number of businesses, including smaller businesses that are now supplying Massmart. And in fact, the program has been so successful. This is one of the competition conditions, if you recall, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that we now are able to see the impact. And then there were a number of other public advocacy efforts, including a visit to Highveld Steel, engagement with rating agencies, meetings on AGOA, labor law conference, and engagement with business leaders on economic confidence. Turning next to the reports on the KPIs, I will draw attention to specific ones, but we have circulated the report. Slide 48 indicates work that we've done on the fourth industrial revolution, on minings and metal value chains, and regional integration. So the regional integration we've covered already in the focus session to the committee, so I'm going to turn to the other two. EDD convened a fourth industrial revolution symposium in December at the Telkom head offices, and we had a range of interesting people there from government people, Naledi Pandor, Siyabonga Kwele, the Deputy Minister Andries Nel, CEO of Telkom, Sipho Maseko, Molapo Thobela, and the head of the IDC New Industries. But what was also significant is the number of business people and trade unions who came and who engaged us on the fourth industrial revolution. That's Sipho Maseko, the head of Telkom. Here are some of the issues that were covered on jobs, infrastructure, knowledge and skills, and R&D. big data storage, startup culture, entrepreneurship, and marketing, quite as well as some of the ethical issues that are identified in the fourth industrial revolution. Honorable members will see there the Deputy Minister of Economic Development sitting next to his colleague, the Deputy Minister of COCTA, and Minister Twele and Minister Pando. The open session had a range of interesting comments. There you see a few comments by trade unionists, academics, the Wits Business School academics, private sector players, from commercial bank people to BUSA. And then 14 work streams were identified that the country needs to respond to in the next few years. And they are set out on slide 54 and 55. And one of the planned activities that came out of it is to do work on the setting up of a digital economy commission, and the president announced that in the State of the Nation address subsequently. The next area we deal with is the research on mine rehabilitation. It's work that originally came from a request by the Portfolio Committee on mine rehab. And so the next number of slides sets out the detail of it. I'm not going to go through all the detail because this was pre-circulated, but we did some research on mine rehabilitation, looking at the state of mining generally, its contribution to GDP and employment, what rehabilitation involves, and there are 9 steps that are set out in the PowerPoint presentation. We've also looked at mining properties in South Africa, that there are 72 closed mines in the database that is used. We've also indicated 66% of these mines are inactive. There's no rehabilitation or care and maintenance taking place. That's in addition to derelict mines, these smaller shafts that have been sunk various places. And DMR reported a total of 5,900, almost 6,000 derelict mines. And it's estimated to cost 2 billion rand to rehabilitate 245 former asbestos mining sites. And another, call it 46 billion rand for the closure of other derelict mines. We spend very little, actually. Honorable members will see the figures there. And so we're now looking at what economic opportunities are there. Of course, it's a challenge to have all these abandoned mines and derelict mines. But they also, as we deal with them, we can create employment opportunities. And we've indicated there the rehabilitation of abandoned mines, and we gave a case study of pit lakes that are formed when an excavated mining pit fills up with water. And of course, these kind of challenges also affect the groundwater supply, and is one of the issues around acid mine drainage. Agro mining, which is where you use the topsoil and the top of a mine for agricultural products. Rehabilitation for agriculture more generally, and we looked very briefly at what Australia, Canada are doing, and a case study of Anglo-American's krill colliery. There's also brick production using mining waste, and we gave a case study there of Mpumalanga Youth Group, and that represents some of the work that has been done on the mining side. On agriculture and agro-processing, we provided some information to the committee on the drought and its impact, and that shows agricultural production, and honorable members will see this sharp drop from a high point in about 2015, and then the recovery now in agricultural production. This slide provides a little bit more detail on what has happened by quarter and by province. We recall for the information of the committee, agricultural employment, which currently stands at 849,000, and we break it down the changes in employment in different provinces, and we'll see provinces that have grown well are Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga and Northern Cape, and the ones that are still a challenge is KZN, Western Cape and Northwest. The department also provided me with some information on the pulse value chain. This would be for certain bean products, chickpeas and kidney beans. And we provide information on chickpeas and the South African market, looking at global production and import and export of chickpeas, as well as a case study of early work that is being done by EDD in this regard. Turning next to KPI 7, we provide the committee with some information on work that has been done over the nine-month period, culminating in quarter three in various provinces. We've highlighted five provinces, and we hope we can highlight the other four provinces in the next quarter's report. We also provide information on some of the work done specifically in Gauteng, Eastern Cape, and the Sarah Baartman District Municipality, in the Western Cape, in the Northwest, Northern Cape. Each of them has either a paragraph or a slide highlighting the work. On women and youth, we table for the committee's attention work that has been done on youth entrepreneurship in Mangaung in November, led by the Deputy Minister, and this provides what the aims of the engagement was, as well as some of the participants. Work we've done on social accords and an SMME workshop that we organized in the Lepalali area. We provide information on the reports we submit to Cabinet on construction updates, a water use license application that the Saldanha Bay Municipality had been stuck with, work done by the PICC, the various committees of the PICC, and the technical support that EDD through the PICC unit provides to the PICC structures. And finally, in this part of the report, up to KPI 14, we identify work we've done to unblock infrastructure projects. In this case, a project that provides inputs to infrastructure. It's a steel-making factory in Cape Town that uses scrap metal, and it makes a number of products that are used in infrastructure. It sought EDD's help to purchase scrap metal through the preferential pricing system, and following the intervention, we were able to unblock that. We did some work on fast-tracking investment initiatives, and there's an example given on slide 89 of PPXL, which is a plant being set up in Blackheath in the Western Cape, where the department provided support to help unblock the challenge with electricity connection that the plant had. We did work on a company that designs a light to be used in the mining sector, and they could not get approval from the regulator, and we helped them to connect with the regulator, the NRCS. We also did work on evaluating the clothing and textile competitiveness programs, which is a DTI initiative, and we reviewed the progress between 2011 and 2016, and honorable members will see there, particularly in this slide, the impact of the program, where companies that use the program by far outperformed those who did not use the program. During the quarter, we also had a number of strategic engagements with the IDC. They included governance matters. This is the quarter when the IDC submitted its paperwork for the claims in respect of Oak Bay Resources. It was also the period when the IDC finalized the work to change auditors. Job performance of IDC was a big part of the conversation, as well as the other issues raised there. In KPI 20, we did the amendments to the Competition Act that went to Cabinet. We gazetted amendments to the method of calculating various things that is used to determine the filing fees when companies submit merger or acquisition applications to the competition authorities. And we dealt with a number of Competition Commission issues relating to its organogram and strengthening the long-term capacity of the commission. Slide 96 gives a bit of information on work we've done with the three funds, as well as new mergers and acquisitions. Avgri, Honorable Chair, I draw to your attention that one of the things that we're doing now actively is to see how far did our past conditions get to. We're monitoring and quantifying that so we can see where can we do more. We're learning from some of the early examples, and the later ones are even more effective. But Avgri was one of the early ones, and you'll see there the positive impact it's had. There's more detail provided on slide 98. And what it essentially says is 90 million was committed over the 4 years, and we provide how far we've come with that. We also provide information on the 3 years taken as a whole, where Avgri has trained 179 emerging farmers in farm business management, financial management, livestock and crop farming, and is also provided a storage discount to a number of small emerging farmers, and it's now extending it to 14 larger farmers. Massmart and Walmart, we provide information to the committee on the impact of the conditions that were set to their merger. And one of the things I want to highlight is Massmart informed us that the program, even though it was imposed on them as a result of the work of government, they now have become converts to it, and they will in fact extend it beyond the mandatory period. So they've already budgeted for an additional year, and they'll look at it on a year-to-year basis. We give the names of some of the companies that have benefited, and right at the bottom of slide 101 are two companies that they now want to take into the global Walmart supply chain. So it's not only to supply Massmart, but also the rest of the stores. We provide information on the Clicks and Netcare mergers, a new merger that the department became involved in, where I was notified of the merger, and it's a company, Just Toys, as well as an engagement with Isuzu Motors, who's taken over the plant that General Motors effectively vacated when they decided to divest from a number of countries. Slide 22, or KPI 22 rather, we engage with the ITAC leadership. We appointed a new commissioner of ITAC and a new deputy commissioner of ITAC, and dealt with ways of strengthening their impact on industrialization and employment. Slide 106 gives the names. Meluleke Nzimande is the chief commissioner, and Dumisani Mbambo is the deputy chief commissioner. We also reappointed two members to the Competition Tribunal. Well, it was done by the President on the recommendation of the Minister of Economic Development. That's Professor Volodia and Mr. Anton Roskam at some meetings. And that concludes the activity report. On human resources, we've pre-circulated this, 124 funded posts, 117 that were filled by December, some were filled in January subsequently. And In addition to that, we also had 13 people that was energies we could use, either WITS people who were on an MOU with us or PICC people employed at the IDC. We provide information on gender equity, people with disabilities, and personnel expenditure. We've taken out of the personnel expenditure in the latest version information that previously was included on transfers to entities. So this is just the department's data that's in here. Also, the internship program. I'm a little bit worried that it's only 3 interns, so we're going to be looking again how we can ramp up the interns. On the financials, we've pre-circulated the financial information. It's for 75% of the year. So in other words, it takes us to December, and honorable members will see that the department spend 611 million out of the adjusted allocation, in other words, 67% of the total budget, but that includes all the monies that the department receive, including the transfers. The department itself in quarter three spent 187.8 million, the bulk of which was transfers to entities. The next slide, 116, gives the cumulative financial performance for each program of the department. The next one provides it for economic classification. There's this analysis of spending by program in slide 118 and slide 119. There's a transfer to entities in slide 120. And there are some reasons for variations. And of the variance that we have, certain critical posts were filled in quarter four. Goods and services, the projected spend was less than expected as a result of lower demand for certain of the goods and services. The biggest subsidy or transfer that was not affected was the Tirisano Construction Fund, because we worked on putting in place all the governance and accounting systems. And the capital assets, there was a lower demand for capital assets during this quarter. So, Honorable Chair and members of the committee, that summarizes the work of the department, and I appreciate the indulgence of the extra few minutes, Chair, that you've so kindly made available. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Minister. I guess this was quite a detailed report. We just want to thank you for the extent of info that you've given us, especially when we look at the economic performance data quite extensively. If I look at the trade info that you provided, I think that's the data that is quite important for the region, especially how we trade with the region. And also sharing the information on the symposiums that you had, which I think these are two important ones. One of them, I think, also was raised in the committee for quite some time, as that one of Fourth Industrial Revolution. I will really also appreciate the extent to which you went in explaining the info on mine rehab and the associated research info, especially comparative info with the other countries, quite valuable information that we might need also to use beyond this, especially for those who are sitting in other committees like mineral resources and so forth. Another info on drought, I think that to me was quite important, especially the effects on the agriculture as a sector, agricultural performance as a sector, including the effect of job losses within that sector. The KPIs, I think the information is quite clear also on that and the financials. I do think that really in terms of reporting you did qualify. I don't know what members want to say in as far as that, but this is the time we would want to open for engagements with the minister on the report and the department as a whole. The floor is yours, members. Oh, before I even hand over to you, let's also congratulate those additional staff members that were appointed. We can only wish you well, especially the CFO. Yes. Thank you so much. Mr. Atkinson? Who else?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much.
Just a minute before you continue. Yes. I just want to note members who want to speak. About beginning. Ndatitliani. Okay. Over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much, Minister, for your very comprehensive report. First question is with regards to the restated GDP, or the increased GDP figures for the third quarter. Are we going to be restating GDP figures going forward? Is that going to have an effect on our forecast going forward? Then the second point was the quite significant contraction in the Northwest. I think it was about 3.4% or 3.6%. What was the cause of that, and are we doing anything to try and mitigate that quite significant contraction in the Northwest economy? Then the third point was just on your Fourth Industrial Revolution seminar. I'm not sure if the CSIR was invited there, but I would have thought that probably would have been a very good set of people to have there, because we did our visit to the CSIR last year, and I would think that that would be integral to any sort of involvement in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And then that just leads me on to another question, and this does come a little bit out of left field because it wasn't in your report. But some time ago, we spoke about the Centurion Aerospace Village as a potential growth project for the Economic Development Department. And we did a bit of work on that, and it was found that there was quite a lot of corruption. And it got into the news recently that they'd sorted the problem out. And I'm just wondering if anything has been done to try and restart that project. And the reason why I'm asking you that question is when we paid a visit there about 2 years ago, it was a company called AeroSud who were on the facility, and they were building South Africa's very first reconnaissance aircraft, which I think they were exporting as well. And when we went to CSIR at the end of last year, AeroSud were running a 3D printing facility where they were actually making aircraft parts out of powder, titanium aircraft parts. And they seem to be quite involved in the various different state industries. And I think they were meant to be an anchor tenant for the Centurion Aerospace Village as well. So kind of with all those things coming together, I was just wondering basically what is happening along there. And then the final question relates to, you mentioned the fact that there'd been an interaction between some officials from, I think it was from the PICC and the City of Cape Town on water. And I think early on in this term, we spoke about that dam that was going to be built in the Eastern Cape. I think it was the Umzimvubu Dam. And I know, obviously, Eastern Cape has got a major issue with water as well. And obviously, we need to build water capacity. And I was just wondering if you can give us any updates on that as well, whether there's been progress on that side. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Atkinson, I'll begin in.
Thanks very much. Let's really welcome the report. There's a work done, Chair, in terms of BAKE in the Eastern Cape. Reality is that it created some kind of job there. I'm not sure the amount, but there's a work done there. So we really welcome that. Second, we want also to welcome the issue of Old Mutual, intervention around the issue of Old Mutual. That will bring some kind of investment in changing the situation around, and also be able to empower some kind of the BEE, Chair. I will go to this issue of mine, Chair, in passing, in page 58. You see, the crisis is faced with the rehabilitation. There's a child that passed away, I think, in Gauteng, in that area, because of a hole. He was checked, he was never found until to date. So I know it's not a matter of this ETT, but I said I must bring it. You know, this problem, it's a major one because it promotes illegal mining. Because when people see the hole, they make use that entrance. If you are in Joburg, you can find sometimes of 500 to 10,000 people underneath that site, illegal mining. They are kingpins. People are killing each other down there. They stay there for days. We visited them, we see them. So we're speaking from experience around that, in that particular area. We interview them, some of them. Some will tell you, I'm from Zimbabwe, I'm from Africa, all these particular areas. Now, there's also they're able to create a business of some coin, some kind, where you buy a drink for 70 rand, 2 liters. So there's a mother that prepare food and brought that food there. So that's how it's happening there. So that thing is killing our resources. We're talking about illicit flows of monies, but those ones are the ones that we don't talk about. So if you go to Mpumalanga, you find the same, all those areas in that trend, Chair. So I think we really need some kind of intervention of those particular areas. Again, it does not help when you close it. Then there's a sign that there's a hole, that there was a mine here. They use that to come in. They open underneath a side of that particular hole that you've closed. They start to get in there and move far away. So it's another one. Secondly, Chair, in page 74, you see, we want also to welcome the support that we receive from Sarah Batman. It's KPI 7. He has assisted us to identify economic opportunities and participate, and those communities have asked some time that they are able to consolidate and able to develop their local collaboration and develop their local economic development plan. Now, without the assistance of that community and those wards, we to bring them together through the intervention of the ADD, we're not able to have that in Dlambe municipality, in Eastern Cape. So I'm trying to say we observe some of those issues. We want really to confirm those particular issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let's appreciate the presentation, also the hard work that the ministry is putting in from time to time. But I think it's important to commend the ministry for the work that they did for Cisco, the steel company, the unblocking that they did there, which culminated in the company getting the preferential pricing system there. That's very good work. The first concern, Honorable Minister, is on the Northern Cape. The economic contraction there is minus 3.6. We know there are these special features in that province. You know, great area, but long distances between various communities there. What can be done to try and alleviate the situation, to try and, you know, generate some ideas that can improve the economy in that province, jobs and so on? Because one had the opportunity to work there for a little while some time ago. The conditions are really, really bad there. That's the first one. And can we get an update on the situation on the continent? And by the way, thank you very much for updating us about what is happening on the continent, what we are doing on the continent. But is it possible for the minister to update us on what happened to that dam there in the DRC? We haven't heard much about it, the Grand Inga dam project there. We were involved at one time. I don't know what happened. On the Masmat Supplier Development Fund, Minister, we are happy that Masmat wants to continue even beyond the period that was agreed upon. But can we be informed about the companies that are benefiting from this fund? Can we separate them in terms of provinces and so on, or are they all from one province? The same applies to the clothing and textile project on page 52 and page 92. The funding there, are those the loans, Minister, or are those the grants? Can you also get some clarity if it is done province per province, or is it mainly Western Cape? Those are the few questions that I had, Chair. Thank you very much.
Relevant at this end. Any other? Dr. Kadu?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Minister, for the presentation. I wondered whether you could give us an update on two issues involving the Competition Commission and indeed the Competition Tribunal. One is on the banks collusion case, which has gone quite quiet of late. And then secondly, if you could provide us with an update on the data market inquiry, when we can expect an interim or indeed even a final report from the Competition Commission in that regard. And then thirdly, I was just curious about the draft Competition Amendment Bill. There's obviously been a great emphasis by yourself, by the current president and the former president, on using the competition authorities as institutions to drive radical economic transformation. I was curious, in the formulation of that draft bill that was gazetted in December, to what extent was that bill the product of your ministerial panel that you appointed, or how much was it shaped by external stakeholders? And since its gazetting and the public comments that you've received, is the amendment bill still going in the same direction, or has it changed form or shape since then? Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Kadu. But I think I'm going to protect the minister with respect to your third question. I think the time is still coming. This is still the cabinet, the executive area at the moment, and then we'll engage with it as it comes to us. I don't think it's really proper for us to engage on it now. It's quite premature. But otherwise we will be able to the minister will be able to respond to other questions. May I also add on the questions, Minister? Thank you. As I indicated, we would like to thank you for the report. I'm much more interested in the data on regional integration, South Africa and the rest of Africa. Thank you for this information. It's quite helpful, but I'm a bit worried when we come to page 20, where we see how, for instance, China is positioned in terms of Africa's imports in relation to South Africa, as compared to South African imports to their countries. But I also think it's all about international relations, how South Africa relate to those countries, and how hard we work to ensure that those countries prioritize our goods as against others, and how we position ourselves, of course, in that. I'm quite happy because you singled out the two countries, which is Zimbabwe and Angola. I just want to ask a question because, yes, there were lots of stifling by Angola. Yes, one of the issues was the high tariffs, I agree. But we've seen relations improving between South Africa and Angola, and we've seen the president of Angola immediately after resumption of duty, he visited South Africa encouraging that type of relationship on trading with South Africa in various areas, and we've seen also our president upon resumption of duty also visiting Angola as one of the first countries that he visited. So what does that mean to us as South Africa? I know that he did not take the economic cluster with to Angola and Namibia and Botswana, but at least our international relations minister and from the security sector also. But I just want to understand the discussions as to which route are we taking. Like I said, also, when I look at the information you're providing on Zimbabwe, which is quite encouraging, the fact that we exporting trucks to Angola, I mean to Zimbabwe, and I think there's a lot of trade relations between the two countries. And of course, you were cautioning us that not as per caution, but as the reality that Japan is also very active in Zimbabwe. But what I want to ask is, we are in Africa, and how are we positioning ourselves apart from the free trade issues and so forth on issues where we see that countries from elsewhere, especially when you look at the positioning of or the position of UK into Nigeria, for instance, I see UK trying to position themselves into Nigeria, which is of course a very quite a big economy, and I'm getting a bit worried. This is, I think, the second time I ask this question, because I don't know how are we positioning ourselves as South Africa in terms of our relations with that country. We know there's been challenges in that area in the past, but I'm not sure how are we improving our relations with that country. That's one of the countries I can mention, and I can also mention Ghana, which these are the economies that are performing very well. I also would want us to understand, I heard Ntate Tlhane ask this question. But he asked the question in relation to Massmart, Walmart Supplier Development Fund. The same question he asked, I would also want to ask in relation, for instance, Number one, it would be with the measure conditions that have been imposed of AFGRI and Agri Group. The second one is in terms of which other one is that? The construction one. Dirisan, yeah. We just want to see progress. How is that? How are the conditions being monitored? Because we might take for granted that there's progress in terms of implementation of those conditions. How far are they? We just need to get the progress. The information provided is quite clear in terms of Tirisano, that there's still agreement that is not yet fully concluded, and hence the fund itself cannot be implemented. We just want to understand the challenges for record purposes, so that we are able to also make follow-ups if we're not satisfied with the response. As I indicated earlier on, after your presentation, Minister, we just want to commend you on the information provided. And I think the way the information is crafted on this report is quite clear and very direct, very user-friendly too. I think it's information that we can always refer to, and it's quite informative. There's one question under AFGRI measure that I want clarity on the conditions. The 90 million over 4 years to benefit emerging farmers, does this include the land? Because this is one of the, oh no, I mean the 60 million for farmer development, sorry. Is it the 90 million for 4 years to benefit emerging farmers? That 90 million, would it include also the provision of land for emerging farmers? There's farmer development for 60 million rand, which is quite commendable, if I were to say. There are those communities, for instance, or the farmers or people residing within the fire farm areas who have just been given their land back. Those people are still struggling. Are they included in the whole in this? What I want to understand is the extent to which this program or these conditions are going to cover in terms of the regions, regional spread, and also in terms of helping with the cultivation of land to meet agricultural production purposes. I think those are the issues I wanted to clarify, Minister. I hope you...
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to all the members of the committee for the questions. Let me take them in the sequence that they were asked. Honourable Atkinson, at this stage, the revised GDP data has not yet led to any revision of the forecasts. So what economists, Reserve Bank, Treasury, our own people in the IDC who work on these things, what they will now do is obviously look very carefully at where the revisions were, and then very importantly to see what other evidence and information is there that shows that some of this may go into the future. And it's always forecasters tend to be fairly conservative because it's better news to restate figures up than to overestimate performance and then you have to restate them down. So they will see whether the basic trend lines that have informed the revision are likely to continue in the future. We're fairly confident that some of it will positively impact on our future growth. For example, and I've drawn attention in the slides to the upward revision of growth forecasts for the rest of the African continent. And as neighboring countries' economic performance improves, the demand for South African products also increases. And exports is a very big driver of our GDP. Of course, our challenge would be to try to ensure that we also retain as much of the domestic market as possible, because if we lose the edge by significant import of consumer goods, then it may offset some of the gains of a more robust export performance. You've seen my colleague, Minister Nene, is also very bullish about what he expects the future growth forecast to be. But we've not put any numbers to them. On the Northwest contraction, it's interesting to see what has caused the principal reason for the contraction. And interestingly, for 2016, the biggest drop was in agriculture, followed by mining. Now, agriculture, we can only assume may be drought-related. And as the drought breaks in different parts of the country, hopefully that can have a positive impact. Mining, of course, Northwest is very mining dependent, and we've seen in the last year or so a resurgence of commodity prices, so they may help. But if I can connect that to a question that Honorable Kiani asked about Northern Cape. And in Northern Cape, the principal contraction was also agriculture. And in the case of Northern Cape, as soon as the power purchase, as soon as the new bid window arrangements on the IPPs are signed by the state, they are likely to have a positive short to medium term impact in the Northern Cape, because a number of solar plants tend to be clustered in the Northern Cape. So that will have a short to medium term effect. As you build more solar plants, you employ more people, investment come into the provincial economy, and it lifts it. But that model is only a short to medium term model, because once the construction is done, then there's a relatively small impact of the power plants in the local economy, because solar and wind require very few people to operate the plants. So those provinces must follow a diversification strategy. In the case of Northern Cape, that they diversify away from only this significant reliance on renewable energy and mining. And in the case of Northwest, it's also a quite significant exposure to mining. Agriculture is normally that counterbalance. But when drought enters the equation, then it means the shocks of whatever happens to global mineral prices or the bold program on renewable energy immediately impacts on smaller provinces whose GDPs are much, much more vulnerable to single product shocks. Gauteng, Western Cape have more diversified economies, so they can manage the shocks a little bit more. You know, Gauteng still has a significant mining footprint, but because they also have so many other sectors that are strong and prominent in the Gauteng economy, even when there's a blow to mining, it doesn't hit the Gauteng economy quite as hard. On the fourth industrial revolution, Honorable Atkinson, one of the things that the new technologies will do is they will increasingly make redundant human memory. Nowadays, you don't need to at school learn so much data retention, what happened in 1066 in Britain, or in 1652 in South Africa, or in 1789 in France, because you can access them all via Google. When that program is sufficiently advanced, I would be able to say with a bit more confidence than I can say now, given my weak memory, but I suspect we have invited the CSIR and that they were present. But we see the CSIR as a very significant partner in this area. In fact, the then minister responsible for the CSIR was present and was keen that we should have a follow-up meeting on the Fourth Industrial Revolution hosted by the CSIR in the way that that one was hosted by Telkom. Incidentally, Chairperson, the committee would be pleased to know that we keep an eye on the state's or the department's money very carefully. We managed to get Telkom to pay for all the costs of, or most of the costs of the symposium, maybe even all the costs. And for the symposium you attended by Professor Stiglitz, I think the department ended up paying a tiny fraction of the total cost, because we got contributions from Wits University and we managed to leverage off the other people who had also been keen to have Professor Stiglitz in South Africa. So for small amounts of money, we've been able to get these events going. Centurion Aerospace Village, Honorable Atkinson, as you may recall, this project is essentially coordinated by the DTI. So it's not a project that EDD directly is involved in. And there are currently about four tenants, of which Aerosud is the anchor tenant, but they have space for about another, call it about 10 tenants. And that kind of village is part of the opportunities that we will have to more aggressively pursue in future to move into high-tech, high-value-added, high-return economic activities. If you go back to Professor Stiglitz's slides, he made the point about niche manufacturing and the 3D printing for aircraft is exactly that kind of niche printing that or niche production that we need to see more of. So we will find out from the DTI where they are with the work, but they are principally responsible for the activity. On the Simvubu Dam, we have a new Minister of Water and Sanitation. He's identified a resolution of all of the projects as one of his key priorities. And so as soon as he's ready to make the announcement, we would happily share that. But we see the Umsumvubu project as quite important, and has been the main challenges up to now has been to make sure that we can get a funding model that takes account of the fact that unlike a traditional dam that supplies water to big industrial users who can take offtake agreements and basically guarantee that they'll buy the water at an economically sustainable rate. In the case of Mzimvubu, it's aimed at really poor communities. So the ability to fully pay for the water is not there. And so we need a funding model that can work in a circumstance like that. It's not a diversified area like the area that the WIP services, where the mining industry can buy, or the Vaal Dam, where there's a wide range of users. Honorable Piccinini, thank you for the very positive comments. In respect of the points you've made about mining and mining rehabilitation, illegal mining, I think we recognize that we haven't put enough effort in our policy frameworks as government on small-scale mining, or what is called artisanal mining. And in South Africa, as in many parts of the world, the lack of a coherent framework means that quite a lot of that activity is illegal, with all of the dangers of the examples that you've quoted. That, of course, is now Minister Mantashe's area of responsibility, and we would look to him as soon as he's resolved some of the big issues of policy in the industry, like the mining charter, that there will be much more focus on these. And we have a minister who's very knowledgeable about the sector. So I think we have an opportunity now to come up with a framework that deals both with large mining, which you need, as well as small-scale mining that can take up some of the low productivity mining that can still create jobs in South Africa. Thank you also for the comments on Sarah Bartman. I'm going to ask Deputy Minister at the end if he'd like to make any remarks on the work in Sarah Bartman, because he's been leading our efforts there. Honorable Kleani, also thank you for the comments. On Northern Cape, I've responded to that one. On the dam in the DRC, it's the Gran Inga Dam. So the Gran Inga Dam is a number of phases, because it's this enormously large project that will take many, many years before it's completed. Where we're looking at now, the phase that is supposed to be built now is called Inga 3. It's one phase of the Gran Inga. And last year, in about the middle of the year, the government of DRC had made an announcement that there are delays in the completion of the program, and it seems principally it's funding related. The World Bank suspended its one of its loans that it was going to make to Inga 3, and South Africa's role has been principally to guarantee an offtake. In other words, we've said, if you can produce electricity, we would be a buyer of electricity. And of course, we've got to make sure that we help to build that project, because that can be a real game changer for the continent. But because it's such a large project, there are many risks attached to it. And one of the risks is that the amount of money required is so enormous that it's not something that you can have small-scale financial mobilization. You need large global institutions, as well as big players on the continent to work together. We can't really control the pace of project approval and construction, because it's located in a sovereign state that will make its decisions there. We can be supportive. So we will be keeping an eye on the project and see how we can be helpful in it. On the Massmart projects, the projects are not only in one province, although it's because most of the industrial capacity of the country is in Gauteng. It is principally Gauteng. But there's also of the suppliers. There's a supplier, I'm informed, in Free State, one in Northwest, one in Mpumalanga, one in Eastern Cape, and a few in KZN in Western Cape, and then the bulk in Gauteng. On the clothing and textile program, the program that we've looked at is the program that is done on behalf of the DTI. It's not loans. It's like a grant, but it's called a production incentive. So it's based on output. So it's not a passive grant. You've got to be able to show that you are increasing your production and your capability. And it is spread in different provinces, but the clothing industry is, of course, concentrated in only some parts of the country. So it will only go to where you have an existing sector. And the big ones are Western Cape, KZN, and Gauteng. So in information that I have available, which provides some breakdown of it, I would say that Western Cape is marginally ahead of KZN and Gauteng. And then coming in fourth place is Eastern Cape. So it is spread a little bit. But I know that industry very well. Historically, it's had three major areas and a smaller area. And the fund seems to basically mirror the geographic concentration of the industry. So the information is available. If of the figures that I've been given, and as I indicate, I haven't looked at all of them, but of the figures given to me, Western Cape has 41, KZN 36, Gauteng 31, and Eastern Cape 8. And this excludes some of the program. It only includes a portion of the program. I will ask for a more detailed breakdown that includes completely all the elements of the clothing and textile competitiveness program. Honorable Cardo, where are we with the bank collusion case? On that one, well, there are two processes. The first is when the Competition Commission originally concluded its work and it referred the matter to the tribunal. There were a number of banks who filed exception applications. And an exception application would be on any procedural issue. For example, some of them may contend that the Competition Commission doesn't have jurisdiction on a matter like this. They may claim, for example, I'm not anticipating, so this is not based on what actually is the case, this is just to give the committee an example of the kind of things. They may claim that if an activity happened outside the Republic, even if it affected South African rand value, then it can't be prosecuted in South Africa. So that would be the kind of application. That matter now first has to be resolved by the judicial process. Once that is resolved, then the main case can proceed. Of course, some banks have already admitted and acknowledged participation, and so in that case, that part is largely resolved. Two new banks were added in December, a few months ago, in a supplementary affidavit that the Competition Commission filed to say that in addition to the originally named banks, there are also an additional two that they believe should be added to the prosecution. On the data market inquiry, it's commenced, and we're now awaiting a progress report from the Competition Commission. It's certainly our expectation that it will be completed in the new financial year. And there's obviously urgency because high data prices access a significant constraint for South Africa's entry into the opportunities of the fourth industrial revolution. So we'll keep an eye on it, and we are keen to have the Commission make progress, but obviously the running of the inquiry is in the hands of the Commission. As regards the competition bill, Honourable Cardo asked the questions in such a elegant manner that I would have been tempted to try to answer them, but the Chair is right that it would be, I think when the bill is finally tabled in Parliament, then I would feel at liberty to deal with the substance of the bill. But obviously any bill that is developed is the product ultimately of the combination of expert advice and the processes in government and the public consultation process. Is not just a tick box exercise. They raise quite interesting issues, because with any bill that one does, particularly in a complex area like competition, you may intend one thing, but courts may interpret it in a number of different ways. And what the public consultation process helps us with is to get a much deeper sense from the different stakeholders what their fears are about how courts may interpret this, and for us to ensure that the final bill that would be tabled in Parliament is as clinically directed to the policy objectives we have, that they don't unnecessarily cause obligations on companies other than those that we intended, so that there's a solid connection between policy objective and legal instruments used to try to pursue them. Chairperson, on the comments that you've made, thank you for those. I really appreciate that. On the the African trade issue, as in trade more generally, your point that it does in part depend on international relations, not just on price and commercial performance, is accurate. It's a fair comment, and it is an area that we would need to look at how we can get more value from our international relations. South Africa has not sharpened that sufficiently, and so there's a lot of new things that we're doing now to try to ensure that we get much better value out of it. So one of it is some countries we're beginning to develop suggested lists where countries look at opportunities for South African exports of products that we make. I don't think that, Honourable Chairperson, that you need to draw too many inferences from the trip that the President has conducted. I think it was, as his office indicated, an important courtesy visit to the key players in the region. The economic dimension remains critical, and out of the work we're doing now, we're able to arm both the President and the Minister of International Relations with many more talking points that we can pursue in future. In respect of Nigeria, Nigeria remains an important long-term partner for South Africa, because just like European unity was cemented when France and Germany began to work together, so African unity, economic unity, which means greater integration, greater industrialization on the continent, requires, among others, that South Africa works closely, of course, with all the countries on the continent, but including Nigeria, Egypt, and Angola. In other words, other fairly fast-growing, strong, and large economies. Kenya also in East Africa. So we see that it's not a zero-sum game, that if Nigeria goes forward, then South Africa loses. That's often the narrative that's there publicly. But it's in the long-term interest of South Africa that we have strong, growing economies. If Nigeria only produces oil, it doesn't have any reason to buy South African minerals. If Nigeria is a diversified economy, It's a market for our minerals and a market for our capital goods, our equipment that we make in South Africa, our trucks, cars, and other products. So out of that, it's important for us to build these long-term relationships. Of course, Durco and the presidency will be looking at all of these areas in future, these are important relationships. I would make the same point about Ghana, and I think that certainly they are all critical. In respect of AFGRI, if I point the committee to slide 97. Slide 97 would say what AFGRI had agreed to in 2014. This was one of our very early public interest conditions. And principally what we said there at the time is, we leave it to you, just make 90 million rand available for emerging farmers, of which 60 million must be directly for farmer development, and the other 30 million for projects aimed more broadly at rural development. Give discounts to emerging farmers for your silos, in your silos, and on-lend to emerging farmers. Those were the principal things. What we were able to report now is, against the 60 million rand for emerging farmers, in year one, AFGRI made 11 million rand available. In year two, 18 million. In year three, 16 million. So up to March last year, they've utilized 44 million. And we now look to the latest figures up to March this year that we'll obtain. In previous reports to the committee, we provided a few examples of the kind of support. I think there may even have been a photo or two that we used. And we can provide more of that if the committee would be interested in them. On the 30 million for more rural development, not just farmer support, 21 million rand has already been allocated by AFGRI, and it's made 90 million rand loans available and provided storage discounts to date of about 100,000 rand. Its head office remains in South Africa, which is one of our conditions, and have not reported any retrenchments as a result of the transaction. We've also provided on slide 99 a percentage breakdown in each of these. And in slide 100, a little bit more detail. For example, 324 micro farmers have been trained in farm practices. And 23 education projects have benefited about just over 7,000 learners in rural areas. We've also had information from them that they've supported 21 food and water security projects. So these are examples of what the money has gone for. And perhaps in future what we should do is, when we look at some of these, we may want to take a case study or two and just highlight it a little bit for the committee. On the question that the chair asked, in respect of Nigeria, I should make the point that the UK is the sixth largest exporter to Nigeria, and we're the 13th, but even the UK has its relative weight in the Nigerian economy as an export market for the UK has declined as China's has grown. So China has become the dominant player in supplying goods in many, many African countries. On Tirisano, I should distinguish between two parts of Tirisano, or the construction thing. The first is the commitments that they have made on transformation. So there, that's not captured in the financial flows, And there, there's been four significant developments. The first is Marion Roberts has sold the entire construction business to a black-owned company. And we had wanted to see the detail of that work through in quarter four, but it will be one area that EDD would be able to put forward as a success. Then in this new quarter that we're in now, quarter four, the Competition Tribunal approved three transactions involving construction companies supporting the large construction companies supporting smaller black-owned companies. And they include WBHO as well as Robex. On the question of the funding flow, the companies were obliged for the first time last year to begin payments into the National Revenue Fund, and National Treasury has begun to transfer that money now to EDD, and the trustees have been set up, the trust administrators have been appointed, and we're now in a position with the start of the new financial year to begin the process of identifying projects and dispersing monies, because we now know we've got the supply of resources to be able to commit over the next couple of years. I think, Chairperson, that covers all the questions that I've specifically noted, and I wanted to find out, with your permission, if Deputy Minister would like to add in general on the questions that have been asked, but particularly also to Honourable Piccinini's comments on Sarah Bartman.
Okay, thanks, Minister. I think we've gone beyond our time limit by about 5-7 minutes or so, but we will give it's more than seven. I'll give the DM to talk. But then before then, the issue on the 90 million, because here you are talking about the 60 million for farmer development. I just wanted to find out if that would include land acquisition. It doesn't. Okay. Because it's not broken down here in that manner. But if you say it doesn't, it's okay. Okay. Thanks. Dear?
No, thanks, Chair. Just quickly on, to respond some few issues. Minister, it's true. CSIR was indeed there, and they had a very long presentation. It's the one that we defer to the next session. On the issues around illegal mining or artisanal mining. Part of the things why we do the rehabilitation is linked, because those who own mines, they sometimes keep the mine even when they're not using it. So when it's at that stage still belonging to them, they avoid closure because it goes with cost of rehabilitation. So if they keep it in their hands, and they don't close it, it makes them to avoid the those kinds of payments. So when you insist on the rehabilitation, it will then make them insist them on following proper closure processes. It will force them then to close them, so that you then start it as a new mine that's owned by someone else. Then on the matter around Sarah Bartman. It's a practice that we have adopted to look at energies within a space rather than coming in as providers. Energies within the space, and in that space we then mobilize all the economic players, the farmers, the small industrial developers, the others who are in commercial. And then we're discussing with them what is it that they want to do with that space that they are in, and how how can they actually assist each other to get that municipality to be productive. So it's they have committed to, they have decided that we should give them a space to work until now in March, and in April, May, they will call us back so that they can concrete in terms of their plans. The other one I just wanted to refer to is the issue around the matter that you raised, Chair, on why are we overtaken by other countries. Well, they are also historical factors with others, because they've been there, they've been existing as big economies, and they have made their mark there. But with the Chinese, what's interesting, the approach that they use is that it's they've got demand creation kind of an approach. So they enter into Swaziland, put in a lot of infrastructure in terms of your tourism area, in the airport, in your roads. So in this period, you'll see a lot of imports coming in because it's the infrastructure. But whatever they do there also, they then create a long-term demand that is going to be coming their side, which sometimes might be very difficult on our part because of the muscle that you actually have in the country to deal with that. If you look at Mozambique, I think you're familiar with it now, but you may be very unfamiliar when you go there. They have put in massive infrastructure program, a long bridge crossing across Katembe, those things that we used to go with, they are now having a very massive infrastructure. So you've seen a lot of investment coming in. Those imports were actually for the infrastructure. But part of the other things that they are actually focusing on is also beginning to push the other countries to catch up with the revolutions so that they can meet also their demand in future of the ICT that they want to go into. So they push the country into countries into that direction. But in some areas, they actually dump. They do dump the technology that they don't want anymore. So those are the dynamics of those competitions.
No, thank you very much for the. I take it that, colleagues, you covered. Yes. I don't know, on the ingot dam you were covered. Or next time it will come. Okay. For now, I guess we should just leave it there. Minister and the team?
Indicate, that's one thing that I forgot, to indicate that but our own private companies are already entering into some of the countries, especially in SADC, given the environment that is changing. There are a lot of them that are beginning to move into Zimbabwe and so on their own because of the environment that's changing.
Okay. Thank you so much. I think we, as we indicated, that there's a lot of information on this report. I think we'll keep on engaging or looking at the report, and where we're not clear, we can still have time when you consider the fourth quarter report to ask clarity seeking questions, and maybe where we have comments or recommendations to make, we can still do them then. That's in a way of closing the year. But then we also have an opportunity when we engage on the APPs towards the end of the month and beginning of next month. I think we'll be able then to get more clarity on some of the things, because we'll have more time. Right now we are limited in terms of time. Just want to thank you, members, for your attendance, and also thank you for your participation. Minister, thank you so much for the type of information you always feed us on with, and the type of responses that you give. It's always making us much wiser, more wiser than we were when before we had the information that you've given. Thank you so much, and we can always wish you well together with your new team, and we're hoping that this team will take you to the end of the term. Thank you so much. Then we can then close the meeting now. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair, to you and to the committee members.
You are invited for dinner. Where is the guy? Is it, well, who's going to help us? Just a second, I just want to get to land. Okay. Yeah. We'll sit. Okay, the food is served here at 3:15. You're all welcome. Thank you.